Now more than ever. Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price, you want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's, we help, you save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at lowes.com/lowest price guarantee.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Have you ever had a nightmare neighbor? You know, a neighbor from hell? You know what I'm talking about. If so, we want to hear about it in our brand new podcast, Nightmare Neighbors. That's right. We got another one in the works. But we need your stories first. Go to nightmareneighbors.com and send in your nightmare neighbor story. Or call in toll free 888-68-CRAZY. 888-68-CRAZY. And share your nightmare neighbor story with us. And we may talk about it and use it on a future episode of the Nightmare Neighbors podcast coming very soon. Maybe they're your current neighbors. Maybe they were a neighbor from years gone by. Now is the chance to tell your story anonymously. Go to nightmareneighbors.com to share your nightmare neighbor story with us, or call 888-68-CRAZY and be part of the brand new Nightmare Neighbors podcast. Her disappearance has been the inspiration for movies and conspiracy theories abound. From what we know, she was an unsuspecting college student attending classes in Vancouver when late one night a mysterious security video would launch the last minutes of her life onto one of the most talked about modern mysteries of our time. This is the mysterious disappearance and death of Alyssa Lamb.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
The body of Alyssa Lamb, also known by her Cantonese name, Lam Ho Yi, a Canadian student at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, was recovered from a water tank atop the Cecil Hotel in downtown Los Angeles on February 19th of 2013. She'd been reported missing at the beginning of the month. Maintenance workers at the hotel discovered the body when investigating guest complaints of problems with the water supply. Her disappearance had been widely reported. Interest had increased 5 days prior to her body's discovery when the Los Angeles Police Department released video of the last time she was known to have been seen on the day of her disappearance by an elevator security camera. In the footage, Lam is seen exiting and re-entering the elevator, talking and gesturing in the hallway outside, and sometimes seeming to hide within the elevator, which itself appears to be malfunctioning. The video went viral on the internet, with many viewers reporting they found it unsettling. Explanations ranged from claims of paranormal involvement to bipolar disorder, from which Lam suffered. It's also been argued that the video was altered prior to release. The circumstances of Lamb's death once she was found also raised questions, especially in the light of Cecil's history in relation to the other notable deaths and murders. Her body was naked, with most of her clothes and personal effects floating in the water near her. It took the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office 4 months after repeated delays to release the autopsy report, which reports no evidence of physical trauma and states that the manner of death was accidental. Guests at the Cecil, now rebranded as Stay on Main, sued the hotel over the incident, and Lamb's parents filed a separate suit later that year. The letter was dismissed in 2015. Some of the early internet interests noted what were considered to be unusual similarities between Lamb's death and the 2005 horror film Dark Water. The case has since been referenced in international popular culture. So this is an interesting story, obviously a tragic story where someone does, in fact, lose their life. But it has so many bizarre elements to it. And I have some memory of this when it happened. It was the early days of Facebook. It was the ending days of MySpace. YouTube was still fairly new. And, viral videos were kind of an exciting new thing. It wasn't an everyday thing. When you saw one, it was like, ooh, did you see the viral video? It wasn't one of 40 that came out that day. Just to kind of put it into perspective of this case. And it was a weird video. Do you recall seeing it? It's Tony and Sean joining you, by the way, today on the Dark Side of Wikipedia. Do you remember seeing this video?
I don't remember seeing the video. I remember the name.
Yeah.
I remember, and this is one of the first that we've talked about that has happened in recent time. We're not going back to the 80s or even 90s or 20s, but I don't remember seeing the video. I think when you mentioned MySpace, Tom was in my eight favorite friends for, yes, quite a while. So I wasn't a social media expert in the early beginnings. So I have not seen this video.
It's a weird one. And I think what got people really at the beginning when this video was released and she was missing, if I remember correctly, and I could be wrong in this, but I think people at first thought it was some sort of a marketing stunt for a movie because it looked so much like some of the reality-themed movies that had been released at the time, like Paranormal Activity, things of that nature where it's very much very raw, very I shot this myself, and I mean it was security camera footage. So I mean it's what is emulated in movies like that. And the fact that this girl was then missing for a little while, I think there was some speculation at the time of like, well, is she part of whatever this stunt is? Obviously it wasn't a stunt. She ended up dead on top of the hotel in the water system, but it just fit the persona at the moment in history when this happened of a horror movie. I mean, it really did look like it was something that was almost staged, but very well done. But it turns out, obviously, it was so well done, it was real. And the way that this woman was acting in the elevator, obviously, what we have here in this case is someone with a diagnosed mental condition. So that is not something that we're wondering about. Did she have something? Did she not? There was something that she suffered from. So you do have to wonder, and you have to very legitimately go and put, maybe that was at play here. Maybe that is part of what happened. How did she die? How did she get up there is the mystery of it. But the interaction in the elevator and all of that, whether she's seeming to interact with no living human being that's there, that's visible, you have to wonder, was there something else involved? I mean, that's where you kind of get the paranormal people involved. But where my mind kind of goes on this is not necessarily paranormal. And as we talk more about it, as we discuss more of the story and read more of the story, where my mind initially is on it, did something traumatic happen to her? Was she escaping something traumatic that happened to her that caused her to be in such a state where it looks like she's interacting with no one, but she's just trying to reason through her mind and trying to make sense of what she just went through? People do that. People without some sort of mental condition will do that. You're trying to cope, you're trying to process, you're trying to figure this shit out. And if that camera happened to just catch her in that moment, it could look like the person is having some sort of a breakdown, but was she just getting away from a situation? And then off camera, she gets caught again by the person, the perpetrator of the situation, and murdered and ends up in the water tank. But all we see on camera are these few fleeting moments of her away from the perpetrator, away from the attacker, whatever it was. And we're looking at her going, what the hell's wrong with you? Without knowing the whole other side of the story. That's where my mind goes, way more than paranormal in this case. Yes, you know, in a weird, dark way, it's, you know, it's morbidly, I guess, interesting to go, what if there is something ghostly going on? But I think the first thing I talked about, of there being a perpetrator, of there being some trauma going on, and we're just seeing a small piece of her day, is far more likely than something paranormal abducting her and killing her and putting her in a water tank. Thoughts?
Oftentimes, if we don't see the entire situation unfold on video, we often need to add parts to the story to make sense in our brain. I mean, she goes in an elevator, she goes out of an elevator, she goes in and out. That's just a small snippet of where she started that day and ultimately where she ended. So, and the fact of the matter that she's no longer living, will we ever know what truly happened?
Well, and we live in a world today where it doesn't necessarily, when it comes to facts and information, we have more access to it than ever before. But we also live in a world today where even when we do get facts and we're able to completely absorb the full picture of something, and we do not have the full picture in this case, but even when we do have literally the full picture of something from start to finish, there's still a great deal of the population that can look at all that and still go, that's not real. That's not a fact. That's not and people are much easier to already have made their assumption and they've digested it. And here's what came out the other side. And there's no telling them if, ands, or buts that, well, you misinterpreted that wrong. That carrot that you ate was not really a carrot. It was from the Ashley Furniture Store, and it's supposed to sit on the fake kitchen counter. That's why it tasted like wax. Did it look like a carrot? Sure, but it was made of wax. So no, it was not a carrot. It was a fucking carrot. No, it was not a carrot. That's the society that we're living in. So
I didn't want to interrupt you having a conversation with yourself about that carrot.
Yeah.
And then you interrupted yourself. You know what? Another interesting point is when we do get the facts and we do get the entire transcript and we do find out everything, sadly, we have become so dependent on shock and awe. You hear in the TV industry, if it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah.
We don't want boring truth.
Yeah.
Oh, it was just a car accident and they just died because somebody was texting and driving and that's how they died. No. There needs to be a conspiracy theory. The chauffeur purposely had her killed. That's why they ran into the bridge embankment. Even if we have all the facts and it was investigated, but it doesn't hit that threshold of shock and awe, our brain just comes up with another, well, maybe this or maybe this.
Yeah. And that's what where you get stories like this, where you just have bits and pieces and they're very tantalizing because they're just unique in the way that they're laid out. You have so many different directions that it could go. And then people dig in with their answers as to what happened. But nonetheless, a very interesting story. Let's continue on with exactly what we know of what happened with this young woman in 2013. Lam, the daughter of immigrants from Hong Kong who opened a restaurant in Burnaby, just outside of Vancouver, Canada, was a student at the University of British Columbia, although she was not registered at the beginning of 2013. For her trip to California, Lam traveled alone on Amtrak and intercity buses. She visited the San Diego Zoo and posted photos there on social media. On January 26, she arrived in Los Angeles. After 2 days, she checked into the Cecil Hotel near downtown's Skid Row. Lamb was initially assigned a shared room on the hotel's fifth floor. However, her roommates complained about what the hotel's lawyer would later describe as a certain odd behavior, and she was moved to a room of her own after 2 days. Built as a business hotel in the 1920s, the Cecil fell on hard times during the Great Depression to the 1930s and never recaptured its original market as the downtown decayed around it in the late 20th century. Several of Los Angeles's more notable murders have happened at or have connections to the hotel. In 1964, Goldie Osgood, the Pigeon Lady of Pershing Square, was raped and murdered in her room at the Cecil, a crime that has never been solved. Serial killers Jack Unterweger and Richard Ramirez both resided at the Cecil while active. There have also been suicides, one of which also killed a pedestrian in front of the hotel. After recent renovations, it has tried to market itself as a boutique hotel, but the reputation lingers. The Cecil will reveal to you whatever it is you're a fugitive from, says Steve Erickson, a journalist who spent a night in the hotel after Lamb's death. Lamb has been diagnosed with bipolar disorder and depression. She's been prescribed 4 medications, Wellbutrin, Lamictal, Seroquel, and Effexor, to treat her disorders. According to her family, who supposedly kept her history of mental illness a secret, Lamb had no history of suicidal ideations or attempts, although one report claims she had previously gone missing for a brief period. In mid-2010, Lamb began a blog named Ether Fields on Blogspot. Over the next 2 years, she posted pictures of models in fashionable clothing and accounts of her life, particularly her struggle with mental illness. In a January 2012 blog post, Lamb lamented that a relapse at the start of the current school term had forced her to drop several classes, leaving her feeling so utterly directionless and lost. She titled her post, "You're always haunted by the idea you're wasting your life." After a quotation from novelist Chuck Palahniuk, she used that quote as an epigraph for her blog. Lamb worried that her transcript would look suspicious with so many withdrawals and that it would result in her being unable to continue her studies and attend graduate school. A little over 2 years after Lamb had started blogging, she announced she would be abandoning her blog for another she had started on Tumblr, Navul Navo. Its content mostly consisted of found fashion photos and quotes and a few posts in Lamb's own words. The same quote was used in that blog. Lamb contacted her parents in British Columbia every day while traveling. On January 31st of 2013, the day she was scheduled to check out of the Cecil and leave for Santa Cruz, they did not hear from her and called the Los Angeles Police Department. Her family flew to Los Angeles to help with the search. Hotel staff who saw Lamb that day said she was alone outside the hotel. Katie Orfman, manager of the nearby bookstore, was the only person who recalled seeing her that day. She was outgoing, very lively, very friendly, while getting gifts to take home to her family. Orfman told CNN she was talking about what book she was getting and whether or not she was getting would be too heavy for her to carry around as she traveled, Orfman added. Police searched the hotel to the extent that they legally could. They searched Lamb's room and had dogs go through the building, including the rooftop, but the canines were unsuccessful in detecting her scent. But we didn't search every room, Sergeant Rudy Lopez later says. We could only do that if we had probable cause to believe a crime had been committed. February 6, a week after Lamb had last been seen, the LAPD decided more help was needed. Flyers with her image were posted in the neighborhood and online. It brought the case to the public's attention through the media. On February 15th, after another week with no sign of Lamb, the LAPD released a video of the last known sightings of her taken in one of Cecil's elevators by a video surveillance camera on February 1st. The video drew worldwide interest in the case due to Lamb's strange behavior and has extensively been analyzed and discussed. In the clip, the camera at one of the elevator's cab's rear corners looks down from the ceiling, offering a view not just of its interior, but the hallway outside as well. It is somewhat grainy, and the timestamp at the bottom is obscured. At some points, Lamb's mouth is pixelized. At the start, Lamb enters clad in a red zippered hooded sweatshirt over a gray t-shirt with black shorts and sandals. She enters from the left and goes to the control panel, appears to select several floors, and then steps back to the corner. After a few seconds, during which the door fails to close, she steps up to it, leans forward so her head is through the door, looks in both directions, and then quickly steps back in, backing up to the wall and then into the corner near the control panel. The door remains open. She walks to it again and stands in the doorway, leaning on the side. Suddenly, she steps out into the hall, then to her side, back in, looking to the side, and then back out. She then steps sideways again, and for a few seconds, she is mostly invisible behind the wall she has had her back to just outside. The door remains open. Her right arm can be seen going up to her head, and then she turns to re-enter the cab, putting both hands on the side of the door. She then goes to the control panel, presses many more buttons, some more than once, and then returns to the wall she had come into the elevator from, putting both hands over her ears again, briefly as she walks back to the section of wall she had been standing against before, and the door remains open. She turns to her right and begins rubbing her forearms together, then waves her hands out to her sides, the palms flat and fingers outstretched, while bowing forward slightly and rocking gently. This can all be seen through the door, which remains open after she backs to the wall again and walks away to the left. It finally closes. The video was reposted widely, including to the Chinese video sharing site Youku, where it got 3 million views and 40,000 comments in the first 10 days. Many of the comments found it unsettling to watch. Several theories have evolved to explain her actions. One was that Lam was trying to get the elevator car to move in order to escape from someone pursuing her. Others suggested that she might be under the influence of ecstasy or some other party drug, but none was detected in her body. When her bipolar disorder became known, the theory that she was having a psychotic episode also emerged. Other viewers argued that the video has been tampered with before being made public. Besides the obscuring of the timestamp, they claim parts had been slowed down to nearly a minute of footage had been discreetly removed. This could have been done simply to protect the identity of someone who otherwise would be in the video but had little or nothing to do with the case, or to conceal evidence if Lam's disappearance and death had been connected to the result of a criminal act. So that's what we know about the video. It's easy to find online if you want to find it and watch it for yourself and go through it frame by frame and say, this was edited, that was edited, or no, it's completely how it is. I've never really, other than just watching it on YouTube, I haven't really watched it frame by frame. I can see, you know, it would be nice to see the timestamp. It would be nice to have some of those other little pieces that don't lead everyone to go, it's a conspiracy theory, but they're unfortunately not there. It is bizarre, but there are possible explanations to it. I mean, I don't feel this is, there's no possible explanation here, and it's 100% paranormal. To me, when I see it, I do kind of get, maybe there's two things going on here, and it's what I said earlier. I think there was some sort of trauma that happened, and I think she, at the same time, after the trauma happened, may have been having some sort of a mental breakdown as a result and was trying to escape from whatever was in that hallway or somewhere in that building. Maybe not even like pressing on the door trying to get to her or even in that hallway itself visible, but somewhere down that hall, somewhere in some room, I think something happened to her. And she was having a breakdown and trying to escape. That's my guess for the behavior that was being portrayed. And then I think whatever it was, whoever it was that did whatever they did with her that caused the trauma caught up with her and didn't want to be caught and murdered her. That's my guess. That's my theory as a podcaster that knows little to nothing about the case. What are your thoughts?
That would be a fair assessment. I also think if some of us were recorded while we wait for the elevator, I don't know about you, but if I wait more than 30 seconds and I've already pressed the button,
yeah,
and I look up at the floor, how are you still in the lobby? And then you press the button again, mm-hmm. and then you may walk back and forth. And then maybe you have your ear pods in and you call a colleague because you're running late for lunch and you're animated and you talk with your hands. So if you watch a video, I'd say many of us look a little psychotic. I don't think people would say, oh, he's on ecstasy. No, he's just an impatient individual who was going to take the stairs but thought the elevator would be quicker. And I pressed the damn button and I'm still waiting.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter that it's a hotel, this is a small woman, obviously a hotel, there's lots of rooms where bad things can happen.
Yeah.
And the fact that she ended up, oh, I don't know, found in a water tank and she's dead, I can now see that that was looked at a little bit more. But I think my opinion is clearly something happened because she's dead. So I'm not disputing that that's the case. I don't necessarily think that it is her freaking out because she walked in and out of the elevator and had some type of mental breakdown. I think whatever happened, she's just being a natural human combined with the fact that something may or may not have been wrong with the elevator. And because, again, that's the only video that we have.
Yeah.
I think we're trying to make more of it than what it truly is.
I think you could be right there. I mean, I think sometimes when you only have that little piece of evidence, you end up making all these assumptions of what happened. And I mean, if you take a little piece of anything, whether it be if someone is videotaping you throughout your entire day, and then at the end of that, you get 30 seconds of that day, and then you're supposed to come up with what happened during the rest of that day based on that random 30-second snippet that you watched and expect that to be remotely accurate or a remotely accurate depiction of the rest of your day and what happened. It's not going to be true, no matter what it is. And it doesn't have to be anything tragic. It could be, well, the rest of the day, I cooked mashed potatoes and gravy and a turkey, and then I had a campfire. But if the only snippet is of you looking a little frustrated as you're getting out of your vehicle because you dropped the cranberry sauce and your hands are up in the air and you're just kind of flustered and it's been a flustering drive home, but that 30 seconds, you look kind of disheveled and crazy, the rest of the day was completely calm and normal. It doesn't mean it's an accurate depiction or in any way something that you can say, this really leads us to answers to the rest of the story. The fact that she's dead, it's all we have to go off of. We have to identify or take a closer look at it than we would for, you know, nothing. But I do think you're right. I think sometimes we can put far more weight on this little piece of evidence than really what it reflects.
If you were to say that hypothetical actually happened and the only video we have is you being so mad and angry, which ultimately because you dropped the cranberry sauce and then that fire that you made that later that night accidentally started a fire in a and it caught the house and someone ended up dying, you would think that this person is a suspect and they looked to murder someone when in all actuality it was a terrible accident. Mm-hmm. And the only video you have of, God damn it, I dropped my $3.79 can of cranberry sauce and it made a stain on my new khaki pants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of possibilities here. There's also the possibility that there was no attacker, that there was nothing, that there is a possibility. I mean, it ends. It's endless as far as what could have happened here. There is the possibility of suicide. There's I mean, it's bizarre. It's why did she take her clothes off and go to the water tank? That doesn't seem to be a traditional method, but you know, it's there. So I don't know, let's at least as far as I understand it, that is a possibility. Let's continue on with the article and see where it leads us. We are now going to jump into the area of the discovery of the body of Alyssa Lamb. During the search for Lamb, guests at the hotel began complaining about low water pressure. Some later claimed their water was colored black and had an unusual taste. On the morning of February 19th, Lamb's body was found in one of four 1,000-gallon tanks providing water to guest rooms, a kitchen, and a coffee shop. The tank was drained and cut open since the maintenance hatch was too small to accommodate equipment needed to remove Lamb's body. On February 21st, the Los Angeles coroner's office issued a finding of accidental drowning with bipolar disorder as a significant factor. The full coroner's report released in June stated that Lamb's body had been found naked, clothing similar to that of what she was wearing in the elevator video, was floating in the water, coated with a sand-like particle. Her watch and room key were also found with her. Lamb's body was moderately decomposed and bloated. It was mostly greenish with some marbling evidence on the abdomen and skin separation evident. There was no evidence of physical trauma, sexual assault, or suicide. Toxicology tests, incomplete because not enough of her blood was preserved, showed traces consistent with prescription medication found among her belongings, plus non-prescription drugs such as Sinutab and ibuprofen. A very small quantity of alcohol, about 0.02 gram percent, was present, but no other recreational drugs. The investigation had determined how Lamb died, but did not offer an explanation as to how she got into the tank in the first place. Doors and stairs that access the hotel's roof are locked, with only staff having the passcodes and keys, and any attempt to force them would supposedly have triggered an alarm. However, the hotel's fire escape could have allowed her to bypass those security measures if she, or someone who might have accompanied her there, had known. A video made by a Chinese user after Lam's death had posted to the internet showed that the hotel's roof was easily accessible via the fire escape, and that two of the lids of the water tanks were, in fact, open. Apart from the question of how she got on the roof, others asked if she could have gotten into the tank by herself. All four tanks are 4x8-foot cylinders propped up on concrete blocks. There's no fixed access to them, and hotel workers had to use a ladder to look at the water. They're protected by heavy lids that would be difficult to replace from within. Police dogs had searched through the hotel for Lamb, even on the roof shortly after her disappearance, was noted, did not find any trace of her, although they had not searched the area near the water tanks. Theories about Lamb's behavior in the elevator video did not stop with her death. Some argued that she was attempting to hide from a pursuer, perhaps someone ultimately responsible for her death, while others said she was merely frustrated with the elevator's apparent malfunction. Some proponents of the theory that she was under the influence of illicit drugs are not dissuaded by their absence from the toxicology screen, suggesting that they might have broken down during the period of time her body decomposed in the tank, or that she might have taken rare cocktails of such drugs that a normal screen would not detect. The autopsy report and its conclusions have also been questioned. For instance, it does not say what the results of the rape kit and fingernail kit were, or even if they were processed. It also records subcutaneous pooling of blood in Lamb's anal area, with some observers suggesting was a sign of sexual abuse. However, one pathologist also noted it could also have resulted from bloating in the course of the body's decomposition, and her rectum was also prolapsed. Even the coroner's pathologist appeared to be ambivalent about the conclusion that Lamb's death was accidental. Since her death, a Tumblr blog was updated, presumably through Tumblr's Q option, which allows posts to automatically publish themselves when the user is away. Her phone was not found either with her body or in the hotel room, and has been assumed to have been stolen at some time around her death. Whether the continued updates to her blog were facilitated by the theft of her phone, the work of a hacker, or through the Q is not known, nor is it known whether the updates are related to her death. Well, I would think that the answer to the question of the Tumblr blog would be easily answered by Tumblr. Wouldn't you think? If you could, I mean, it is their program. They could take a look and see, is this in queue? Was this posted from an IP address on someone's phone? I would think that that would be a relatively easy question to answer should Tumblr want to answer it.
Yeah, that's a situation you think is a black and white. You just put a request in.
Yeah.
The IT team takes it. But it's a situation as a company. Do you even want to open yourself up to, I mean, if you say too little, it looks interesting. Yeah. If you say too much, it could be a part of investigation, tampering of sorts. That's very... very interesting. When any murder or any death, you then go to social media and how active the account was and last time they posted. And then somebody gets their password and they post on their behalf. I mean, you think it's a very simple question answer. Possibly not so.
I think if someone's dead and there is evidence to be found through a device, whether it be or a website or an app, whether it be Tumblr, whether it be Apple, whether it be whatever, that has a security agreement and a passcode and all that, when the person's dead, I think all bets are off and we can look at that data. I mean, it doesn't need to be made public, but I think authorities should be able to look at it to try and find answers. I know there's like some been cases where Apple's like, no, we're not ever going to give you the passcode to these phones that, you know, were allegedly used by terrorists or whatever it was. I don't recall the whole deal, but I remember it was one of those things where it was like, really? I mean, I get privacy. I get like the person's, you know, the argument's always just a slippery slope. If we do it for this, it's going to be used for that. And yeah, I guess that is a valid argument to some extent. But there are certainly cases where I think, look, it's not everything is just as black and white as it's going to go to this to that. In some cases, it's like, look, this is just what we need to do to figure out why this person is dead and possibly prevent other people from dying. You know, if there's any clues to be had that are going to tell us, well, the phone is fucking active. You know, it's over here. It's in another part of the city and she's dead. Yeah, that's some information that and it could simply be, you know, a kid found the phone, you know, lying in the hallway of the hotel and now he's using it. And I think we could narrow that down pretty quick of whether this person was the murderer or not. But it would at least give us another clue to say where the phone was found. Maybe there's more clues there. Maybe, there's just certain things with technology where I get the slippery slope argument to a certain extent. But I don't know. I mean, we're in a world where we care so little about our privacy. It's interesting. We care so little about our privacy, yet we care so much about our privacy. We are in a state where we are so fucking sharing of every goddamn thing that we do on social media. At least some people are. Far more people than were in the past. Yet it's such a violation. We feel so violated every time, you know, one of these things like, you can't have that passcode. You can't look at, it's like, really? I mean, how much of the information is just already out there that we've posted? I don't know. It seems to like really flow both ways. We're so superly protective and at the same point, we're not at all, you know?
You had an ultrasound on your quadruplets that you posted on your public Facebook profile with your name, your social security number, your blood type, your birthday from the doctor's office that you took the picture. Yet your daughter is missing and we need to get into her iPad. No, I'm sorry. I can't give that information.
I mean, and it's not that their parents were doing that by any means, but it's the fact that the companies don't. They won't unlock the devices in many cases.
Correct.
And it's like, well, maybe in certain cases we should be doing that. I mean, that's just not everything. It's not an across the board, the police say, unlock this phone, we should do it. But I do think in some cases it should be done. I mean, it's for the general interest of the population that this be done. When it's a public safety thing. And of course, it's one of those slippery slopes, quote unquote, where it's like, well, if you're going to argue that, then you could argue this. And yes, this conversation could go in 1,000 circles if you're sitting there arguing with me as you're listening to this in your car. But I do feel in some cases there is a need to access information that may otherwise be locked, and especially when there is a way to do so. Well, didn't Apple like a while back say that they can't unlock it or something or to certain devices. Like if we wanted to, we couldn't do it, which I find to be a bullshit argument. It's like, I don't fucking buy that. I believe there's a master way to get through your shit. At least at the factory.
I don't remember particularly what case it involved, but yes, there was a statement, even if we wanted to, we couldn't.
Yeah.
I'd like to think that you would not hire programmers that in no way, shape, or form can you get in. And there's also the argument that all camera phones, I mean, they're always watching.
Yeah. I mean, all these things, they're watching the audio on all of your, I mean, I'm not going to say the word out loud because I have like three of them nearby. we'll say it rhymes with Calexa, and Yuri, and I have them all around me, and they get triggered all the fucking time when I'm not even talking to them, and I'll get weird responses and shit. So yeah, they're always listening, and we know that. And it's just, it's one of those things where in life you have to kind of say, I really have nothing to hide. I don't care, because the benefit, and this is a personal thing, I'm not saying everybody has to do this, but if you feel the benefit and the convenience of what those products offer is a fair enough trade-off for these things to really be listening to you all the time, because the convenience and what it offers betters your life as in terms and does not add a negative to it, then you should have no issues with these things. But if you feel that there's information being dispersed amongst your house or wherever these are that you really truly do not want others to hear, then don't have them. And that's simply the solution, because this is how they function. This is how they will always function. And they're going to get more and more smart and how they work. And it's just, it is what it is. It's either you have it or you don't. I really could care less if there's some fucking person at Amazon or Apple listening to my conversations. I could give a shit. There's nothing you're going to get out of it. And in reality, it's not. It's a computer and it's listening for algorithm. It's listening for certain words to be said so it can feed ads to you. That's usually what it is. You know, if the FBI ever somehow, someone said I was a terrorist or something and wanted to investigate me and wanted to tap into my Alexas and my Siris and listen to my conversations, I don't fucking care. They're not going to find anything. So to me, it's almost like in certain ways, it could be a security factor or a security blanket of like, really, this is what you suspect of me? Go ahead and listen to my Alexa for the last month or whatever you want, and you will find no evidence of anything you're making an accusation of. So, I mean, you could even look at it that way, too.
I agree. If you have nothing to hide, then you have nothing to worry about.
Yeah, I mean, that's just, maybe it's a very simplistic view of it, but that's, I don't know, that's just kind of how I look at some of that, where it could work. It's not always going to work in some sort of nefarious way. One more section here. Litigation of the case. In September, Lam's parents filed a wrongful death suit, claiming the hotel failed to inspect and seek out hazards in the hotel that presented an unreasonable risk of danger to Lam and other hotel guests, and seeking unspecified damages and burial costs. The hotel argued it could not have reasonably foreseen that Lam might have entered the water tanks, and that since it remained unknown how Lam got to the water tank, no liability could be assigned for failing to prevent that. In 2015, the suit was dismissed. The circumstances of Lam's death have been compared to plot elements in the 2005 horror film Dark Water. In that film, an American remake of an earlier Japanese film of the same name based on a 1996 short story, a mother and daughter move into a rundown apartment building. A dysfunctional elevator and discolored water gushing from the building's faucets eventually lead them to the building's rooftop water tank, where they discover the body of a girl who had been reported missing from the building a year earlier. A life had imitated art with Dark Water. The creators of the films and television shows used the Lam case as inspiration for their own works. In May of 2013, the episode Watershed aired as that year's season finale of the ABC series Castle, in which a New York police detective and the title character, a mystery novelist, investigate crimes. In Watershed, the duo pursue leads in the death of a young woman found dead in a rooftop water tank at the Cedric Hotel in Manhattan. Among the evidence is a surveillance video of the woman taken in an elevator. Ultimately, she's found to have been posing as a prostitute in order to investigate another guest in the hotel. Another ABC series, How to Get Away with Murder, had a similar storyline over a series of flashbacks spread out across the season, which began airing in 2014. It's revealed that a sorority girl missing at the start of the season was murdered and that her body had been hidden in the water tank on the roof of the sorority house. Similarly, her body is only discovered when a maintenance worker is called to the house to address the water pressure issue. In Hong Kong, from which Lam's family had emigrated to Vancouver, filmmakers were also inspired by the case. Nick Chang, an accomplished actor in Hong Kong films, made his directorial debut in 2014 with Hungry Ghost Ritual, a horror thriller that includes a scene in which a ghost terrorizes a young woman in an elevator, shot to look like security camera footage and believed to have been inspired by the Cecil's Lamb footage. In mainland China, director Li Hao announced a year after Lam's death that he would be making a film based on it. He went to Los Angeles himself and stayed for a few days at the Cecil doing research. Chinese media have reported that popular actress may be interested in playing Lam. Liu said if he made the film, it would be likely an American-Australian co-production in English. In March of 2014, a little over a year after Lam's death, brothers Brandon and Philip Murphy sold a horror script, The Bringing, that uses the investigation into the backstory for a fictional investigating detective's slowly unraveling sanity. They were widely criticized for doing this so soon after the death. Danish director Nicholas Winding Refn was originally slated to direct the film, but in August it was announced that Jeffrey Lovering would direct the film for Sony Pictures whenever production would begin. In 2014, video for Vancouver pop duo The Zolas' Ancient Mars is meant to be an idealized representation of Lam's last day, showing a young woman exploring Los Angeles and taking in simple pleasures. It bugged me how tidily people explained away her disappearance with drugs or mental illness, said singer Zach Gray, who attended UBC around the same time and had a friend who knew Lam. Though it's mostly fiction, we want people to see it and feel like she was a real girl, a familiar girl, not just a police report. Later that year, the American post-hardcore band Hail the Sun wrote Disappearing Syndrome, also inspired by Lam's story. It's such a chilling and eerie case, said the band's guitarist in a Reddit Ask Me Anything forum. In 2015, the media speculated that the fifth season of American Horror Story was inspired by Lam's death. And late spring creator Ryan Murphy said the next season would be set in a hotel in present-day Los Angeles. He was inspired, he added, by a surveillance video of a young woman who got into an elevator in a downtown hotel and was never seen again. He did not use her name, but it was believed he was talking about Lam. In 2017, Sun Kil Moon released the songs Window Sash Waits and Stranger Than Paradise as part of their album Common as Light and Love Are Red Valleys of Blood. The song specifically referenced the event and promote the idea that it was a hoax. Band member Mark Kolizek said it in an interview, I have come to the conclusion that nobody died in the water tank. There's no way to identify the girl on the elevator as her face is pixelated. It's an interesting argument that the whole thing is a hoax, but I think those sort of things can be, you know, you hear those arguments being made a lot these days when it comes to tragic events. You hear the term crisis actor and things like that thrown out. I mean, fuck, you got people that will flat out argue and say, like, the people on United 93 didn't exist or they were crisis actors and they found them in other places. It's like, well, then you can make that argument from afar, I guess. But the thing is, when you actually do the research and you actually dig into it, you discover, oh, there's families of these people, families that are mourning, families that have been torn apart, families that are going through horrible, horrible times. And to hear shit like the word crisis actor thrown around is just like spitting in their face. It's like, no, these are not fucking crisis actors. These are people who existed. And I'm sure if you looked, I personally have not, but I'm going to put money on if you looked into the family of Elisa Lam, you will find that they are people who exist and have lives and are probably relatively easy to get in touch with if one wanted to find them. And you could very easily confirm that this person existed, had a life, disappeared, and these people are missing their daughter. And the bullshit that you hear from afar of crisis actors, I find in most cases to be completely abhorrent, especially when it comes to things. One of the most disturbing ones I've ever heard is when it gets thrown around about Sandy Hook, of crisis actor parents and shit like that. It's like, are you out of your fucking mind? And the answer is usually yes. But to say that, it's a very simple explanation. It plays into a conspiracy theory that's quickly, you can wrap it up.
But no, it's not the answer. These people lived. These people have people attached to them. So I do not go down the road at all of it was a hoax or it's a crisis actor or anything like that.
It just is a continuous feeling of needing to shock and awe. You can't just be okay with the truth.
Yeah.
And conspiracy theory, I don't know. That's not my view really on anything.
No.
I don't consider myself to be gullible, but should I choose to investigate and get the facts of the matter, and then you make an assessment. I don't personally feel the need to, well, there's got to be more to it. There's got to be more to it. This is just, that's not what it truly is. But there's also people out there that they have a very difficult time looking at it face value and taking it for what it is.
Sure.
They always think there's something more to it. And you know what? Hats off to you. But I just don't have enough time in my life to do that.
And you know what? And I do think conspiracy theories do exist. Just not everything is a conspiracy theory. For example, there one thing that is recent in mind and in culture that has happened that I fully believe it has more to the story than what is out there. Jeffrey Epstein being murdered in prison. I for one second do not believe or killed himself in prison is what the official story is, that he committed suicide in prison. While on suicide watch, and the judge taking suicide watch off of him, and him getting a cellmate that looks like the worst possible cellmate you would ever want to have if you don't want to be killed in prison. I mean, it's just like, okay, no, I think he was probably killed in prison because he knew far too much about far too many people with power. And I think the conspiracy theory there is real. Someone had him killed in prison because he knew too much and there was far too much of a risk of him exposing prominent political figures for what they are and for things that they've done. So their conspiracy theory, yeah, I buy into that one. But there's many, many, many others that I do not. I think conspiracy theories are not the exception and are not the rule. And we've kind of come into this place in our world right now where conspiracy theories are almost accepted as the rule and not the exception. And it's either like you believe all conspiracy theories and they all must be true, or you don't believe them at all. And it's that gray middle ground, which is most of reality, where could some be real? Sure. Yeah, definitely. Could a lot of them not be? Sure, definitely. But it's the tribalism that we've gone to where it's like you're either all in or you're all out. And this gray area of like, well, let's look at everything at its face value and for who it is and what it is and make our judgment on the individual situation, case, person, whatever, and make our decision there on how we proceed forward, not make it on, you know, well, because Jeffrey Epstein seems like a pretty obvious conspiracy theory, this one must be true too. No, I mean, you can't connect those dots. They're not related. But I mean, but it's a thing. It's almost like I think conspiracy theorists, it's like an addiction. Once you start getting into some of them, they're pretty damn interesting, even on a surface level, even if you know, like, there's no fucking way this could be true. But the conspiracy theory arguments are really, really interesting. And if you're go down those rabbit holes just enough, and if you have a mind that's just enough in a direction that leans that way, it's not hard to persuade yourself to keep going down that road and then start thinking everything is a conspiracy theory. There's just sometimes weird coincidences. There's just sometimes weird shit that happens that you can't really explain, but it's there. With this case, it was something that came to mind where they talked about how creepy or eerily similar it was to a movie that came out prior to her death, or a story that came out prior to her death. There was also historically a book that came out about the sinking of a ship called the Titan. And it sank. The book came out, I believe, like 3 or 4 years prior to Titanic. the actual events of Titanic. It had so many eerie similarities to it, and I don't know them all off the top of my head. I did when I was a kid. But it's everything down to, like, names of people, size of the ship, certain tonnage, certain things, just so many damn things that were like, oh my God. Like, it was almost like prophetic of what this book was to what the Titanic became. And I don't believe it was a prophecy or anything like that, but it was one of the hell of those weird coincidences, you know, down to the name itself of the fucking ship. But it was just that. It was a book about a disaster, about a scary situation that happened. And I think in this case, it probably is something along those same lines too, especially with Japanese horror and things like that. In Chinese horror films, they have a great horror culture over there that creates all these just bizarre, dark, scary fucking stories. And then a few of them get remade for American audiences. But the originals are, like, by far just scary as shit if you're cool with subtitles. So it's not too far for them to go down a road like this with their horror genre and have this be the plot. So I don't know. I mean, it's just one of those things. That's my long tangent. Go ahead. Your turn. I've been hogging the mic.
I just have, and this has nothing to do with conspiracy theory. This has everything to do with bad luck. And do you believe when you leave Earth, when you die, it's planned? When you're born, mm-hmm. it is known how you're going to die. You don't know, but as far as in the script of life, or do you believe it's just a random, you might die today?
Are you like the manifest destiny type thing where, like, everything happens for a reason and your death is one of those? Like, it's already, the universe knows when you're going to die. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Because in the part that you were describing yeah. about the Cecil Hotel, mm-hmm. somebody tried to commit suicide. So I would presume they jumped off the roof and they hit a pedestrian and the pedestrian died on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to go, somebody's trying to take their own life and then they hit you and they kill you too and you're walking on the sidewalk, that's just yeah. beyond me.
I think it's one of those things where it can be a double-edged sword, because you can walk through life and you can constantly say when things work out certain ways, it's very easy to go and say, I believe everything happens for a reason. And we tend to do that more so when good things happen. I mean, sometimes we do it when there's bad things as like a coping mechanism. And sometimes I hear it and I'm just like, that's the dumbest fucking thing I've ever heard. Like after Sandy Hook, I heard some people say that. It's like, well, everything happens for a reason, you know. It's like, fuck you. Like, no. Fucking all these kindergartners did not fucking deserve, or first graders deserve to fucking get gunned down. Fuck you. I don't believe that was this happened for a reason thing. But at the same breath, in my own life, you know, I have said, you know, when something good has happened, or even like something bad, nowhere near as what those families and stuff went through with like Sandy Hook, but have, you know, tried to cope with something and said, you know, maybe this happened for a reason and it's for the better or whatever. So it's a coping thing that I think we do as humans. We try and find reason. We try and find logic. We try and find this, you know, everything happens for a reason thing. But it goes back to the question of, does it happen for a reason? Because if you're going to say events happen for a reason, you're going to also have to say death does too. So I don't know. I mean, and is there a caveat to it? Is there a way to cheat it? Is there a way to change it? Is there a way for, you know, the universe to kind of have this path that wants you to go on, and either you follow it and things work out one way, but it is your choice? I do not believe, you know, it was the choice of like the Sandy Hook children or anything, like, because they went to school that day that happened to them. So I think that would be the exception to the rule, where I can't really say I truly believe everything happens for a reason, because I don't believe that sort of shit. That shit happened because of a horrible fucking person. So you can't like argue it both ways, you know, because it like if you pick one, you got to pick the other. I don't think there's a big gray area there. So as much as I think it'd be easier, and sometimes I think without thinking, I believe that path of when it applies to me selfishly, narcissistically, would be like, yes, you know, I think my death is, the universe already knows it. In reality, no, I really don't think so. I think some things happen for a reason because we've set ourselves up into situations where they're more likely to happen. And we put ourselves into situations where hopefully more good things happen than bad. We can also do the exact opposite. We can also make a shitload of poor choices and have a lot of bad things happen to us. And then you can get into the victim mentality as well and go, oh my God, I'm being really oppressed here, or really bad shit happens to me. And it's really a result, if someone from afar can look at you and go, well, you've been putting yourself in bad situation after bad situation or making poor choice after poor choice. Yes, the odds are in your favor that bad things are going to happen because of where you are setting yourself up in life and what you're surrounding yourself with. And then there's the random things that can just happen too. Even you've done good things, you're in a good situation, you can get hit by a fucking car. A murderer could have escaped and have found refuge in your home and killed your family and raped everybody. You know, there's all sorts of caveats to everything. But I think there's a lot more randomness that goes on than there is necessarily like manifest destiny and it's all pre-planned. But we do have influence on creating our odds. I guess that's my long answer to that question. You have more control of your odds by your choices that you make. Does that make any sense?
Moral of the story, absolutely. Don't walk by hotels with high stories.
Yeah, I mean, and this is not in any way to dismiss this woman's death by any means, but from what I'm gathering here, this sounded like a shady hotel in a bad part of town. If I was to stay in a shady hotel in the bad part of town, I would think my odds of something negative happening to me would go up versus staying at a nicer hotel in a nicer part of town. Now, then you can go to the argument, well, maybe she didn't have the money for the night. And I'm not arguing. I'm not saying, well, she should have just stayed at a more expensive hotel. Maybe she didn't have the money for it. I get it. But the choice was made to stay at a shady hotel in a shady part of town. There's more likely, statistically, a chance of having a negative experience there. In some cases, ending in death. So I'm not blaming her by for someone taking her and killing her. And if there was violating that went on, that's not her fault by any means. But it's one of those things where you put, if you go into a dark alley in a dangerous area, yes, you could get hurt. If you go into a tank of or a field of alligators and think you're just going to walk through it with red meat attached to you, you could have a negative thing versus walking through a empty pool with nothing in it. And those are choices that we make. And sometimes we make them because we just make them. Sometimes we make them out of economic circumstance, and this is all we can afford to do. Sometimes we make them out of ignorance. Sometimes we make them. There's all sorts of ways choices are made. Oftentimes, if it was a bad choice, we can look back on it and go, yeah, that was a bad choice. But we set up our odds of things happening by the choices that we make. Is it right that bad things ever happen? No. When someone else is doing something negative towards us. But when we put ourselves into situations where those odds increase, they simply increase. And that's just what it is. And, you know, not everything is going to be this perfect 50-50 chance of something bad happening or no chance of anything bad happening because you're you. You know, it's just, it is what it is. Anyway, that's, I think that's kind of how I view all of that. I mean, it could go on forever about all the different possibilities of that. But that is the interesting, the dark, and the obviously quite disturbing story of the death of Alyssa Lam on today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you listen to us so you don't miss any of our episodes. And leave us a review there on Apple Podcasts if you could. We'd greatly appreciate it. For Sean, I'm Tony. Thanks for listening to The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.
The new McCrispy strip is here. Dip approved by ketchup, tangy barbecue, honey mustard, Sprite, McFlurry, Big Mac sauce, double dipped in buffalo and ranch, more ranch, and creamy chili McCrispy strip dip. Now at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Rakuten is the smartest way to save money when you shop, because members get cash back at over 3,500 stores across every category, including fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, travel, dining, and more. Your favorite stores like Lenovo and Wine.com pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the commission with its members, and that could be you. Cashback is deposited directly into your PayPal account, or if you prefer, Rakuten can send you a check. The choice is yours. You can even maximize your savings by stacking cashback on top of other deals, like store sales and coupons. You're already shopping at your favorite stores. Why not save while you're doing it? Membership is free and it's easy to sign up. Get the Rakuten app now and join the 17 million members who are already saving. Cashback rates change daily. See Rakuten.com for details. That's Rakuten. Your cashback really adds up.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. June is Men's Mental Health Month, and every year, 6 million men suffer from depression. If you're feeling overwhelmed, the strongest thing you can do is ask for help. And BetterHelp makes it easy. Take a short online quiz and connect from home with a qualified therapist. Visit BetterHelp.com to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.